Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with our analysis of the Iraqi weapons transfers, which eventually became better known as the Iraqgate scandal. In our first segment, we were taking a look at the ramifications of the defection of two of Saddam Hussein's sons-in-law, including Hussein Kamel, who was in charge of his weapons procurement program, including advanced weapons and weapons of mass destruction, along with Saddam's other son-in-law. He defected to Jordan. This has in turn prompted a number of disclosures by Saddam Hussein of the true state of the advanced weapons and weapons of mass destruction program that he was involved in. Apparently, his nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare capabilities were far beyond what, or considerably beyond what had previously been thought. The exact motives for the Iraqi government disclosing that information remains to be seen. Some have speculated that it is to avoid or to preempt disclosures by Hussein Kamel and Saddam's other son-in-law concerning the nature of these disclosures. What is fascinating, too, is that Hussein Kamel, in his position as the director of the Iraqi weapons procurement program, including weapons of mass destruction, worked intimately with not only the Reagan and Bush administrations, but also U.S. intelligence. In our first segment, we took a look at a company called Johnson Consultants that was essentially used as a cutout by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Reagan administration. Both Robert Johnson and Richard Smith of that firm were basically known as agency people. They, in turn, worked with two American businessmen, one of them of Middle Eastern extraction named Larry Hickey and Fred Hauptsch. In turn, those individuals worked very closely with Hussein Kamel, obviously for quite some time, an intimate of U.S. intelligence. One wonders whether perhaps that relationship is ongoing, and if so, what ramifications that had. What we're going to look at in this segment is the role, once again, of the United States, this time using the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. That is an Italian commercial bank, one very closely connected with the P2 Lodge, as we have seen, that was used in the Iraqgate weapons, or the weapons transfers that became known as Iraqgate. And as we shall see, many of the weapons of mass destruction, and in particular the delivery systems that we have already looked at, were financed, their development was financed by the loans that the Atlanta branch of the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro was able to secure. Those loans ostensibly to finance agricultural products being sent to Iraq, as we shall see, those agricultural products were rather unusual agricultural products. We are once again going to rely for our information on the landmark book Spider's Web, subtitled A Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq, that was authored by prize-winning journalist Alan Friedman of the Financial Times of London, published in hardcover by Bantam Books, copyrighted 1993. Now, the Christopher Dragoul, D-R-O-G-O-U-L, that you're going to be hearing about, was the manager of the Atlanta branch of BNL. He was sort of the scapegoat for the Iraqgate scandal. Officially, he was found innocent. The U.S. government and the Bush administration were found innocent of any wrongdoing in connection with the Iraqgate scandal. As we shall see, Christopher Dragoul and the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro came to be involved in this particular scandal, and came to be involved in particular in procuring the financing for some of Saddam Hussein's advanced weapons and weapons of mass destruction development programs. Christopher Dragoul was acting as an intermediary for U.S. intelligence and the Reagan administration. Turning once again to Spider's Web, of the role of the BNL Atlanta branch and Christopher Dragoul, Alan Friedman writes as follows. As Dragoul's career soared, so did Saddam's appetite for money and arms. In 1984, the Iraqi leader redoubled his arms procurement efforts around the world. Not only was he fighting a war, but he badly wanted fresh funds to finance his nuclear ambitions. But first, he needed more basic equipment. By late 1984, when Washington reestablished its diplomatic relations with Baghdad, a variety of American expedited efforts to assist Saddam were well underway. Intelligence information and satellite photographs were regularly going to Baghdad. Past and present CIA contractors, such as Sarkis Sognalian, Soghanalian, were plying their arms trade and reporting back to the Reagan administration on what was being sent to Iraq. With the full knowledge of the CIA, the Iraqi leader was obtaining U.S. equipment and technology through Carlos Cardoen of Chile. By the way, we took a look at Carlos Cardoen and his relationship with James Guerin, a company called SLC, and also the recently deceased Nasser Bedoun, who was assassinated in Latin America, specifically in Brazil. Continuing with Spider's Web. From Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the indefatigable James Guerin was busy selling military goods to South Africa that would go to Saddam. His activities were also being monitored by the CIA. Even some of the big U.S. grain traders were briefing the CIA on their Iraqi activities. Christopher Dragool knew nothing of these Western government and intelligence services operations to help Iraq, but he was about to be drawn into them. It was unwitting at first. In late 1984, after nearly 36 months on the job at BNL Atlanta, he received his first invitation to do business with Baghdad. The fateful offer came from one of America's biggest grain traders, Continental Grain. The company had heard that Dragool's Atlanta branch was involved in making loans with CCC backing, although he had made none for Iraq at this stage. Quote, Continental Grain called to inquire whether we might be interested in handling a $13 million transaction to Iraq involving a shipment of wheat and flour, unquote, Dragool remembered, again quoting, We had never done business with Iraq before, so I called Rome and asked them for permission. They said, quote, Iraq? No problem. Go ahead. So we did, unquote. Thanks to the Continental Grain deal, Dragool saw a new world opening up for him, a world of easy transactions backed by U.S. government loan guarantees. Everyone was so friendly, so solicitous. Grain companies like Continental, Cargill, and Louis Dreyfus seemed to beat a path to his office on Peachtree Street once they had heard about BNL's willingness to lend. It was a small community, and word traveled fast. And then there were the Iraqis themselves. Dragool was put in touch with them by a business associate at Continental Grain. He did not realize at the time how significant the introduction would be. A meeting was set up in New York at the Sheraton Hotel. Dragool traveled up from Atlanta in the company of his deputy, a Bronx-born loan technician named Paul Von Wedel, or Wedel, W-E-D-E-L. The two made an offbeat pair. Dragool was calm and somewhat Continental, while Von Wedel's demeanor more closely resembled that of a raucous used car salesman. At the Sheraton, they received a warm welcome from Sadiq Taha, T-A-H-A, the politically powerful Director General for Loans at the Central Bank of Iraq, who doubled as a frontman for Saddam's arms procurement network. The match between the rather junior bankers from Atlanta and the worldly-wise Iraqi was decidedly uneven. When an offshore company needed to be set up or financed, or when Hussein Kamel or others responsible for Iraqi weapons procurement needed to make discreet bank transfers involving large sums, Taha was the man they called upon. More about the BNL's role as the funding conduit for the financing of Iraqi weapons, including, again, the weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, and in particular, some of the delivery systems. In the August 23rd New York Times article that we read in our first segment, we took a look at the arming of Scud missiles, long-range, relatively long-range Scud missiles, with chemical and biological warfare agents. Those missiles had their range expanded, partly as a result of technology that was financed through the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro. Among the other delivery systems for the weapons of mass destruction were the Condor II missile project. And so again, as we contemplate the disclosures now being filtering out of the Middle East, and again contemplate the role of Hussein Kamel in the Iraqi weapons procurement program, including the procurement of advanced weapons and weapons of mass destruction, bear in mind that he worked intimately with U.S. intelligence and with powerful elements of the Reagan and Bush administrations, basically those administrations, period, in acquiring many of the weapons and the technology that are currently making headlines in August of 1995. More about the BNL and its role in financing Iraqi weapons purchases. The goods that Iraq wished to purchase with the $2.1 billion in loans the BNL extended in 1988 and 1989 were not the kind that would be eligible for purchase with CCC loan guarantees. There was no question of the loans funding food exports. Many of the exports Iraq bought were officially termed, quote, industrial products and technology, unquote, but a number of them were put to final use as components of Saddam's war machine, quote, It doesn't matter whether it's machine tools or computers. The one thing they have in common is high technology. It all clearly has an arms linkage, unquote, explained a British government official who had watched BNL's loans assisting exports to Iraq. More than $1 billion of the BNL loans were to be coordinated with a government ministry in Baghdad that handled military procurement, including conventional weapons, missiles, cluster bombs, and the ballistic missile, nuclear, and chemical weapons projects. This ministry was called MIMI, an acronym for the Ministry of Industry and Military Industrialization, and it was run by Saddam's son-in-law, the powerful Hussein Kamel, who in 1989 welcomed Chris Dragul to Baghdad, offering him pomegranate juice and his gratitude for all that BNL was doing. Saddam was eager to use the money from BNL to finance his lifelong ambition of seeing Iraq achieve the status of a nuclear power. Washington, Rome, London, and other NATO governments knew very explicitly that this was the Iraqi leader's ultimate goal. Quote, "We have been tracking every aspect of Iraq's military procurement effort since the autumn of 1984. It is not a pretty picture," unquote, said one of the British government's top advisors on nuclear policy in the autumn of 1989. But cabinet ministers and government heads throughout Europe and the United States rarely turned their attention to the minutiae of arms procurement networks, and powerful business lobbies wanted to sell to Iraq. There were profits at stake, and it could easily be argued that not every piece of equipment would find its way into a nuclear weapons plant. The result of both private sector greed and gross government negligence was that Saddam was able to obtain much of what he sought. In both the Reagan and Bush administrations, this dangerous attitude represented a notably cynical brand of, quote, business as usual, unquote. Between February of 1988 and July of 1989, BNL Atlanta made good on its unsecured loans to Baghdad by processing more than 2,500 separate letters of credit for companies in the United States and Europe that exported equipment and technologies to Iraq. Some of Dragul's loans went straight to front companies in Switzerland that were sending sensitive, NATO-based equipment and technologies to Baghdad for the Condor II missile project, Saddam's high-priority ballistic missile, that was at the top of the State Department's list of dangerous nuclear proliferation risks. In late 1988, a BNL Atlanta letter of credit was agreed for exports to an Iraqi entity called Project 395. This was Baghdad's codename for the entire Iraqi missile program. One more time, that last sentence. In late 1988, a BNL Atlanta letter of credit was agreed to for exports for an Iraqi entity called Project 395. This was Baghdad's code name for the entire Iraqi missile program. Obviously, interrupting, that would involve not only Condor II, but the Scud missiles that we heard about in our first segment. Continuing. Other BNL Atlanta loans went directly to Iraq's Technical Corps for Special Projects, the state agency that ran the Condor II and other missile projects. Not all the loans that helped Iraq's nuclear projects were clearly labeled as such. On April 8, 1989, BNL Atlanta provided a $5.4 million credit to finance the shipment of what was known as, quote, 300 tons of yarn, unquote, by Entrade, E-N-T-R-A-D-E, a Turkish-owned New York commodity exporter, that had benefited from CCC-backed loans and had become one of Dragul's best clients. The destination of the Entrade yarn was listed clearly on a telex sent to Dragul from Baghdad, the Iraq Atomic Energy Commission. Either yarn had become the newest ingredient in atomic research, or Baghdad was being circumspect about the nature of the actual goods it was buying. Among those who received BNL money were a number of companies that formed part of Iraq's weapons procurement network, including Iraqi front companies in London, such as the Technology and Development Group, or TDG, and TMG Engineering. Both were owned by the Al Arabi Trading Company of Baghdad, the master procurement vehicle that was itself controlled by Hussein Kamel. Skipping down, of the BNL role in obtaining financing for, among other projects, the Scud missiles that were, among other things, going to be mounting chemical and biological warfare warheads, the Spider's Web and Alan Friedman relate as follows. Dragul's loans funded many genuinely dangerous projects, such as improving the range of Saddam's Soviet-made Scud missiles, and providing thermal imaging night vision components that would allow Iraqi troops to see their enemy in the dark. This sophisticated military technology, manufactured by the Hughes Aircraft Company of Santa Barbara, California, was shipped by a Belgian company that received nearly $28 million of Atlanta credits. In effect, Dragool provided finance to any American or European exporter who was directed to him by the Iraqis. After his friend Sadiq Taha underwent a heart transplant operation in early 1989 and was replaced at the central bank, Dragool finally saw with his own eyes the military use that Baghdad had made of his bank's money. His new Iraqi counterparts proved entirely different. They were no-nonsense military procurement men who worked directly for Hussein Kamel. In the spring of 1989, on his last trip to Baghdad, a visit was arranged for Dragool and Von Wedel to the Nasser Industrial Complex in the company of TDG executives. There, Dragool viewed a bomb plant and a machine tool production plant filled with Matrix Churchill equipment. By the way, that is a British company, one of whose operatives was Mark Thatcher, yes, the son of Margaret Thatcher, of course, Prime Minister at the time. Continuing. Thanks to BNL's Atlanta loans, Matrix Churchill had provided equipment that went straight into Iraq's nuclear missile project. Its computer-controlled lathes helped shape the very missile casings. No longer could there be any doubt about what Baghdad was doing with the Atlanta loans and of the role of BNL financing in helping to build Iraq's chemical weapons capability. We read the following in Spider's Web. There was a huge Iraqi petrochemicals complex called PC2, which apparently doubled and was focused largely on the development of chemical weapons. Skipping down in Baghdad. If Baghdad's nuclear weapons ambitions were acknowledged by London and Washington at the time, they were officially condemned by them. If Baghdad's nuclear weapons ambitions were acknowledged by London and Washington at the same time they were officially condemned by them, the same was true of Iraqi chemical weapons development. The Iraqis would frequently order BNL to provide funds to finance a huge petrochemicals complex called PC2, located about 70 kilometers south of Baghdad near the natural gas feeder lines that came from the southern oil fields. PC2 was to be the pride of the Iraqi military establishment because it had the support of contractors from the United States, Japan, Italy, France, and Britain. More significant, as Western intelligence agents knew, although PC2 would manufacture normal petrochemicals upon completion, like many of Saddam's disguised operations, it would be dual use. This meant it would be able to generate chemical compounds needed to make mustard gas and nerve gas as well. The head of Iraq's chemicals industry, Lieutenant General Amer Hamoudi al-Sadi, was proud of PC2. Al-Sadi was himself a dual operative. His other job was the head of Saddam's ballistic missile and chemical weapons programs, reporting to Hussein Kamel and his father-in-law, Saddam Hussein. The general contractor on PC2 was the Bechtel Corporation, a familiar name when it came to Iraqi business. Bechtel was the company that had been ready to handle the Aqaba pipeline project back in 1984, the project for which George Bush had lobbied Exim Bank so hard. The pipeline project had never worked out, but in the summer of 1988, Iraq asked Bechtel's London office to manage the entire PC2 petrochemicals project. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad was pleased for Bechtel, as was the Department of Commerce in Washington, which encouraged Bechtel to go ahead. Managers at Bechtel thought nothing of the request from Baghdad that they accept payment through letters of credit issued by BNL Atlanta. They also gave little thought to the fact that the plant's principal product, ethylene oxide, was a chemical that is easily converted to thiodiglycol, which is used to make mustard gas. So again, the Bechtel Corporation basically, at least for a time, was running the PC2 complex and was centrally involved in it, a petrochemicals complex that was intimately connected with the weapons procurement program run by Hussein Kamel, recently defected to Jordan along with another of Saddam's sons-in-law. We have been looking in this segment at what could be termed an escalation of the Iraqi weapons transfers, whereas in the first segment we were taking a look at the role of U.S. intelligence cutouts in arming Iraq with conventional weapons on behalf of U.S. intelligence and the Reagan and Bush administrations. In this segment we have been examining the role of the Atlanta branch of the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro as the funding conduit for arming Saddam Hussein with a variety of weapons development programs aimed at at developing nuclear, chemical, biological, and biological warfare weapons, as well as the delivery systems, including the Scud and Condor II missile systems that were to be delivering those weapons. So as one views the headlines currently coming out about the alarming state of development of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and the missiles and delivery systems with which to apply that weaponry, bear in mind that the Reagan and Bush administrations, elements of U.S. intelligence, elements like the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro acting as a proxy, elements like Robert Johnson consultants, again acting as a proxy, were intimately involved along with the ubiquitous Hussein Kamel or Kamel Hussein, one will see the name both ways, in the arming of Iraq, including the development of weapons of mass destruction. It is also more than a little ironic that the United Nations is centrally involved in monitoring the Iraqi weapons development program, and indeed in the August 23, 1995 New York Times article, we took a look at pronouncements and disclosures by United Nations officials. The current Secretary General of the United Nations is Boutros Boutros-Ghali. As we shall see in the concluding segment of Spider's Web that we're going to be looking at in this particular segment, Boutros Boutros-Ghali was the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak at a time when Hosni Mubarak's government was acting as a conduit, for many of the Iraqi weapons procurement programs. In particular, the Mubarak government was deeply involved with the development of the aforementioned Condor II missile project, one of many projects which received concrete assistance from the United States. And again, we've been looking at the BNL role in that. What we're going to look at next is the role of George Bush in using Hosni Mubarak as a conduit for instructions to Saddam Hussein on how to use his Air Force. This at a time when George Bush was supposedly just making a non-political trip to the Middle East. Returning to Spider's Web by Alan Friedman. On Monday, August 4th of 1986, George Bush was in Cairo nearing the end of an 11-day swing through the Middle East. He had been shuttling across the region on Air Force Two. When he set off on his trip, the White House was asked if the Vice President had a policy goal in mind. Since Bush and James Baker had been gearing up for Bush's presidential campaign to succeed Ronald Reagan, the answer was no, quote, nothing but politics, unquote. This was somewhat disingenuous. Although there were a dozen campaign-style photo opportunities during the trip, and television crews filmed Bush meeting Israelis and visiting the Egyptian pyramids, no cameras were allowed into his two-hour private meeting with Hosni Mubarak. While Bush was in Cairo officially to continue the search for a Middle East peace, to strengthen diplomatic relations, and to spread good cheer, he had more than good cheer in mind for Mubarak. Bush had been briefed to talk to the Egyptian president about how Saddam could best bomb the Iranians. According to a member of the senior-level group that prepared the brief, the vice president carried out the request that had been made of him after the White House meeting in late July. He asked Mubarak to tell Saddam to make better use of his air force against Iranian troops. For his part, Mubarak needed little persuading. The Egyptian president was a pragmatic man with a chameleon-like ability to survive. To the Americans, he was a reasonable partner, a leader with whom one could do business. To Saddam Hussein, he was a friend and a weapon source. It didn't matter that Saddam had led the Arab world in condemning the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt. There were other realities for Mubarak, such as his need for oil and money and political allies in the Middle East. Indeed, during the 1980s, Mubarak sold some $3.5 billion worth of missiles and arms to Iraq, only to find Saddam later refusing to pay for them. In 1984, he also agreed with his colleagues in the Egyptian government to work with Iraq on a secret nuclear-capable ballistic missile program for Iraq that was named the Condor II Project, or, as it was called in Cairo, BME, for Ballistic Missile Egypt. By the time of his meeting with Bush in 1986, Mubarak had turned Egypt into a channel for a wide range of NATO-based missile technologies that front companies in Europe were smuggling to Baghdad. Among Mubarak's government cronies at the time of the Condor II project were Abu Ghazala, G-H-A-Z-A-L-A, the defense minister, and Boutros Ghali, the Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. Now, of course, Boutros-Boutros-Ghali is presiding over the United Nations, which is attempting to monitor the very weapons development programs, which were being assisted, in part at least, by the government of Hosni Mubarak, apparently, with the at least passive acquiescence, if not active assistance, and the latter seems more likely, of the current Secretary General of the United Nations. Oh, what tangled webs we weave when we practice to deceive, as the old saying has it. And indeed, among the individuals apparently helping to soil the sheets in the Middle East was the current Secretary General of the United Nations. For more background on some of the political underpinnings and intelligence underpinnings of the Iraqgate scandal that we have been examining in our last two segments, I recommend a source called the Archive Shows, in particular, Radio Free America Program 38, and also an interview with John Loftus, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews, hardcover, St. Martin's, 95. All of those archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. More about that right now.
Tape cassettes of Dave Emery's archive documentaries and weekly One Step Beyond programs are available from a tape duplication service. The service is Archives on Audio, and you can contact them at Post Office Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Once again, that's P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number and area code are 415-346-1840. A 12-page catalog listing and describing each archive show is available.
That's now a 20-page catalog, and again, neither myself nor the station makes money out of this arrangement. People looking for titles, books, in this particular field of research would do well to check with Antifa Book Service. That's A-N-T-I-F-A. They can be contacted at 945 Taravale Street, T-A-R-A-V-A-L Street, number 117 in San Francisco. The zip code is 94116. They stock or can obtain many of the titles used in the archive shows and on this program. So please, those of you who are hunting for books, contact Antifa Book Service, A-N-T-I-F-A Book Service, at 945 Taravale Street, T-A-R-A-V-A-L Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. This concludes this particular segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.